The reading from the Vajjanga Samyutta, the 46th chapter of the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is the first one called the Himalaya. Bhikkhus, based upon the Himalayas, the king of mountains, the Nagas, nurture their bodies and acquire strength. When they have nurtured their bodies and acquired strength, they then enter the pools. From the pools, they enter the lakes, then the streams, then the rivers, and finally, they enter the ocean. There they achieve greatness and expansiveness of body. So too, bhikkhus based upon virtue, established upon virtue, a bhikkhu develops and cultivates the seven factors of enlightenment and thereby achieves greatness and expansiveness in terms of dhammas, wholesome states. And how does a bhikkhu based upon virtue, established upon virtue, develop the seven factors of enlightenment? Here, because a bhikkhu develops the enlightenment factor of mindfulness, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. Develops the enlightenment factor of discrimination of states, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, cessation, maturing in release. The enlightenment factor of energy, the enlightenment factor of rapture, the enlightenment factor of tranquility, the enlightenment factor of concentration, the enlightenment factor of equanimity, which is based upon seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, maturing in release. It is in this way, bhikkhus, that a bhikkhu, based upon virtue, established upon virtue, develops the seven factors of enlightenment and thereby achieves greatness and expansiveness in terms of dhammas. That's really, some of these things are really kind of beautiful presentations. They start with the description of the Nagas, which are these kind of cosmic serpents, cosmic cobras. They're often configured as cobras. Sometimes Naga sometimes means an elephant. So it's a quasi-spiritual entity rather than a physical one. So which is basically a creature of great power associated with nature, supernature. Creature of great power can be benevolent or destructive, as nature can. So in a way it is a symbol of the potency of nature. And in the Buddhist understanding, nature is not just trees and flowers, it means spirits, a vast, multi-layered cosmos of spirits, entities, gods, demigods, earth spirits, goblins, demons, human beings, animals, and right down to mind states, are all kind of stacked up like a series of microcosms nestled inside each other. So it's kind of undivided, all the conditioned realm, from the intimate thought to nature of the moon and stars and to qualities and entities to which we no longer ascribe belief. But certainly part of that universe in those days. And so the Buddha doesn't refute this. It's not pivotal to the teaching because here he just uses a metaphor anyway. As a simile, saying just the way these potencies in nature, in which we all have natural potential, can be immersed in something beautiful, such as virtue, and gradually expands into an increasingly expansive and nourishing flow. And this is the ways, this is a simile for the nature of our own chittas, our minds, our hearts, same thing. Same process. Yeah. The emphasis here, based on virtue. If we really expand what that means beyond just keeping rules into customs, observances, procedures whose nature is to bring around harmony in terms of conditions. So we look at it very broadly like this. It's a sense of between people, between, fellow monks, monks and nuns, nuns and lay people, human beings and animals, human beings and trees and planet, our responsibilities, the ways we do things, all of this to be enriched, because it establishes a very fluent and unbroken sense of relationship, which is non-domineering and doesn't avoid it either. It's not trying to drop out of the cosmos, but how to release any attitudes, fixed positions, clinging, brutality or indifference towards it. So in a way there's a cleaning of the heart from destructive tendencies. So we can look at it very simply every day, you know, if we're out there sweeping the paths, that's an aspect of sila. You have to treat the brooms carefully, they're not particularly robust, so there's a sense of mindfulness, you sweep, you're attentive to areas that need firm sweeping, some areas need to be lightly traced, so you're not just kind of pounding away blindly at things. There's a sense of relationship, which is, that's what mindfulness is, so it's based upon that sense of relating to what we're doing and to any qualities that are present in that. You know, so we're not here to worship brooms or consider them the most important thing, but that's what I'm handling right now, so this is what I treat with care, mindfulness, and a sense of rather just callous or indifferent, or mind going elsewhere. What's the point of sweeping today? Tomorrow it's going to be a mess anyway, so why bother? No, it's true. But why bother is not a wholesome Dhamma. Getting frantic about it isn't a wholesome Dhamma either. But just this is what we do, because why bother is not a wholesome Dhamma, because if we don't do this, then gradually the paths disappear, it gets more difficult, weeds grow, you get to do more work to try and get through. So that process of keeping things clean. And we were the same thing with our minds, really. You know, if we become casual, slack, careless, then at a certain point it doesn't really matter too much. But gradually that sense of dustiness takes over till you the points where you're really clear upon become narrower and narrower. So even looking after your kuti is an aspect of sila. Because if you don't give that kind of due attention, what are you doing? Thinking about this, no problem, practice isn't going very well, and, after all, maybe I should be somewhere else anyway, and this really fits me. Is that doing you good? Is that a skillful Dhamma? Is that helpful? Is that giving you release, or is it just taking you into a rabbit hole of preoccupation? So no, relating to where I actually find myself as being on a physical level, then just keep it tidy. The mind doesn't get sunk into its preoccupations, is called upon to relate. And not frantically, we're not trying to make something fantastic, we're just careful. So the tonality of careful attention is maintained through attending carefully to what we're doing. That modality of careful intention supports mindfulness. Mindfulness supports right energy, inquiry. And we found out somehow just in treating our kuti, our paths with respect, suddenly all that turmoil of what am I doing, where am I going, is kind of evaporated. Where did all that go? You dealt with it by not dealing with it, by, well, not going into the topic, but sustaining the atmosphere and the proper tenor and quality of mind that tends to cause hindrances to evaporate, tends to lessen the power of obsessiveness. Yeah. And then we just kind of bear with it. And you see, holding that process, sustaining that process, careful attention, maintaining carefulness, maintaining, you know, responsiveness, some of the stiffness and lethargy, frenzy and preoccupations of the mind are not fed and they fall away. This is a very fundamental training process made much of in forest tradition. This is the meditation technique, careful attention. Because if you enter that, and the careful attention is based upon in doing things carefully, it's a sila, it's a quality of sila. It's not obsessiveness to the physical appearance of things, or fascination with the physical appearance of things, it's carefulness and attention to how I'm relating to things. So, you know, you go to a monastery, you don't like the Buddha there, looks a bit weird to you, you don't really think much of this Buddha, doesn't it satisfy you? Well, but it's a Buddha. You don't look at it like that. You look at it as an item you treat with respect. Whether you like it or don't like it is kind of sort of secondary, really. Because it's an object you use for respect. And this, when you get that, oh, that's all right. Oh, yeah, I see. Oh, that changes things. Suddenly it doesn't, my attention doesn't do that. You know? If we cultivate like this, then in some ways, everything is a Buddha. You know? I like it, don't like it. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, but, you know, what does that do? If you like it, you want to hold on to it. If you dislike it, you want to reject it. You want to support those dhammas? No, they're not going to get you very far, are they? You get stuck. These are the dhammas that give rise to clinging. Whereas proper relatedness helps to alleviate clinging because the nature of form isn't something we're really that obsessed about, but at the same time we're not ignoring it. Form is form. It's just that. So then your mindfulness is based upon proper relationship rather than on appearance. And so sometimes these, particularly some of these forest teachers and forest monasteries, you know, teaching in their own right, you go somewhere and it's like, my goodness me, this is really, you know, some of them are pretty basic and yet kept perfectly. You know, it's cleaned every day immaculately. You know, ragged robes, And something, this is telling me something. You know, it reminds me, this isn't about form. But it's not about dismissiveness of form, it's about relationship. When you establish that, then you have a basis for inquiry, both into the nature of form and into how your attitudes are. Because, you know, form is an appearance, that's all. So if you say something like a physical body, most of us see it from the outside. We see the surface of it, so we take that to be the body, the appearance, that appearance. Because that's what we're familiar with. And generally they're upright, clothed, so forth, hair on top, feet, so forth, or body. But then if you take one, cut it open, it's very difficult when you open up, you know, a body to really relate to what you see as being the same thing as when it's intact. Often the autopsies, they peel the face off. It's very difficult to see it as a human being anymore, even though it hasn't changed that much. In some ways, you've just done a few snips. And we all know, after about the age of 5, that under the skin there's lungs and liver and entrails and so forth. And it's a very different creature. But when you see that, probably most people feel some sense of shock or even disgust. Ooh. What's that? Horrible. Sick. Don't even talk about it. Well, what happened there? You know, we get stuck on a particular appearance. And so we can't bear that change of appearance. I mean, the issues people have about the change of their physical appearance through aging processes, what skin does, what fat accumulates or disappears. We get stringy, we get flabby, bodies do. And it's going to be a major topic of preoccupation. But whatever you do, form, it still appears. And people, by and large, tend to have a rather negative sense of their appearance and how they regard their own body compared with how other people regard it. It looks okay to me. Oh no, don't you see these kind of pouches under my eyes? Oh yeah, so what? Don't you see all those wrinkles? Oh yeah, I get what you mean, but that isn't, you know, I see it and I don't see it. So that obsessiveness, this is where, of course, we get with that clinging that comes in. A sense of I am comes in. And the I am comes in as a result of a particular relationship of clinging. The form is constant. No, form is not constant. It's shifting and changing. It's a collage. Yeah. So even just the physical body, you see it standing up, it's actually rather different from when it's lying down, or when its hair's shaved, or it's got a beard, or, you know, and then it's changing its shape as it moves along, it comes more fluid. And yet we retain an overall impression in the back of our minds, oh yeah, that's a man or a woman or... Well, it's an old person because they're limping. So you maintain, actually form is constantly changing depending on how you regard it, and particularly the perceptions that arise from that. Perceptions of beauty or non-beauty. You know, what we feel comfortable with, what we don't feel comfortable with. Mm. shift and change. And it can be quite deliberate. You know, you can entertain fashion dispositions which deliberately, like gothic or goth, where you make an effort to make the body look grotesque, you know, or punk, you know, you deliberately make it look kind of, well, grotesque, you could say, you know, and that's good. It's good how nasty you can make it look is kind of good. Or you could go the other way, you know. So all these dispositions play out upon form, depending on how one's hold it. But also you can just see, well, whatever it is, it's purely an appearance. And all these various passions and dispositions play across it. And isn't this a bit kind of tedious? Can you just let it be what it is, and whatever it is, treat it with care, respect? Wouldn't that be more steady and comfortable? Yeah. So this is the process, viveka, seclusion, which means a certain withdrawal of attention from states that we can recognize are associated with infatuation or obsessiveness or, you know, withdrawal. Viraga, dispassion, means you're not really emotionally stirred up one way or another by it all, because you've seen it as just changeable and not the point. The point is how you relate, not what the thing is. Yeah, so viraga, you just get, it's okay, whatever, you know. You don't have to look that good or be that great. And that's the thing. Oh, what a relief. That brings cessation. I mean, certain dispositions, passion, aversion, switch off. Cessation. Certain tendencies to what we seek, what we look for in each other begin to cease. I'm not looking for excitement, entertainment, being infatuation, just not interested in all that. And certain qualities just end. Because once you really begin to know what is the stable and the steady and what is the energy we want to bring forth, and stay with that. Stay with that. Then it's something I can get guidance through that. And this is what leads to release. Release from attachment. Clinging. Taking a position. And fundamentally, all this amounts to identity. Which the average unawakened being will take as their fundamental norm. That's the baseline. Not how I relate, but what I am. And that's the unit. That's the unit in existence, is the sense of here I am living my life, stuff's happening around me, I've got to get through, da 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 da. And, you know, some friends, job, nourishment, so forth. Yeah, it's a reasonable vehicle, but it just doesn't lead to the end of suffering. In fact, it often builds it up. You know, if that's all there was, we'd make the best we could of it. And again, a person of integrity, realizing if this is all there is, they'll try to do the best they can to be a good, decent person who's managing things okay, tries to be helpful, which is all blameless. And yet, it's not the end. Suffering, and there's further potential that could be developed, which would not dismiss that person's integrity, good intentions, but actually liberate them from the consequences of attachment. And very, you know, very simply speaking, we expect results. And the results that we get are probably not in line with what we hope for. Yeah. So this fundamental instinct for the citta is to find firmness and solidity and safety. And that for the unawakened being seeks that in an identity that is in holding on and orienting around appearances and how they can handle the conditioned world, how they can get on with it. The awakened being sees through the conditioned world as this is just the appearance is changing, which is nothing substantial finally there. It's all a matter of perspective and view. Just keep relating to it. And so then the Buddha said, well, you know, when you look contemplate, you can consider five particular ways in which a citta relates to experience. It's consciousness, it goes out into sense consciousness. So that lights up, that tells us where we are. Sight, sound, touch, taste, thought, and so on. But actually, it doesn't tell you where you are. It tells you what's changing around you. And seeing something is nothing like tasting it. Seeing an apple is a completely different experience from tasting it. Listening to a person is not the same thing as touching them. So these are very different experiences. Different sets of data come in. And they all change. So consciousness, although it's incessant, is not very reliable, apart from giving you a murky experience of, well, here I am in something, but it's all shifting, but I am the solid entity within all this shifting stuff. And then you, okay, who's that? No answer. And then we get forms. You recognize our own this physical form. Forms around us are all subject to change. So, where's the constancy in that? Feeling. Pleasant, unpleasant. Definitely moves us, shakes us around, but it's very mobile and doesn't last very long. Pleasant. Taste of the unpleasant pops up, moves along, changes. Perceptions, meanings, what we attribute to a day, oh, it's a terrible day, oh, it's a rotten day, you know, rainy and cold and grey. But actually, if you're in the Sahara Desert, this would probably be considered what a relief. To have some rain, relief from the incessant blazing sun. So the meanings are very sketchy and based upon no final, you know, ultimate truth in them. And the responses that come up, liking, disliking, wanting, not wanting, all this stuff flickers and changes. I guess it's just all happens is we get a lot of activity going on, comparing and contrasting, you know, planning and so forth. We just get a lot of activity. Where does it go? Just keeps going. These are called the five aggregates. Yeah. But if there's a clear sense of stabilizing the activity to whatever it is, however it is, I like it or dislike it, or at least maintain respectfulness and non-contention and non-grasping to it. That will allow the perceptions to change, the feelings to change. Yeah. And then my identity becomes much less fixed, becomes more fluent and open. Cultivating within the sphere of conditions an unconditioned, that which is free from these conditions of grasping, rejecting, identifying, or even trying to switch it all off. So you have room then, you have greater opportunity. So just looking very modest things like one's own aging process, thinking, well, I'm sort of 70, 74, I think. Which is some things you're just not going to be very good at anymore. It's not a sense of shame, it's just natural. My mind just doesn't do the kind of bright, buzzy things, intelligent things other people's minds do. It doesn't do it. I look at a spreadsheet and feel a vague sense of panic. Other people rejoice in the clarity, and I just feel, what's all this? It doesn't do it. I could feel, I could call myself names, being an idiot, but no, it's just that's what happens. It does that. So, well, then other people can do that. Beautiful. I'll help out, I'll sweep up. I can still do that, just about. I can do the washing up, just about. For a while, before that goes. And then whatever, you still maintain friendliness and respectfulness. You don't have to have a particular performance capacity. Because virtue is not about performance. It's about purity of heart. That's what you value most highly. And being prepared to shift as you're young, you've got a lot of vigour, well, you do these kinds of things. And then after 5, 10 years or so, you've got a lot more experience, you start doing these kinds of management things. After 20 years or so, 25 years maybe, it's now time to just put it down because you're past it. But it doesn't stop the main thing, which is purity. Purity of heart. And then just not having to have a great identity. That's some of the, well, to me, it's one of the beauties of this life is certainly kind of you tend to get one. Though I don't personally hold it that in such a fix, but certainly I get seen as in a particular way as an identity, and okay, if it supports proper relationship and it's inspiring and helpful, it's wonderful. I don't regard myself in quite the same light, but I'm prepared to accept that I have biases and attitudes. I don't know. Main thing is not how people relate to me, but how I relate to them, that I have some say over. And recognizing, whatever you do or say, somebody's gonna like it, probably somebody won't like it, somebody will understand it, somebody will misunderstand it, and you can't blame people, it's just the way it goes, really. Yeah, maintain your purity, what you have some say over. And then this is really about, this is withdrawal, skillful withdrawal, not, you know, being irresponsible, but being responsible for the most important thing. And always adjusting everything else in accordance with that. You get dispassionate about whether you're, how you're seen and, you know, what you're doing. It doesn't really matter. Nobody's here for fame or positions. We all just chip in what we can according to what we're, how things shake down, really. And you can take this kind of motif right through to refined levels of meditation. So you look at something like the Anapanasati Sutta, you see this sequence kind of presented. You know, you have collections of teachings. And a lot of them are about a progressive process of ripening and strengthening and, you know, they're called the samadhi process or the samatha process. Things are just becoming, you know, constructions, mental constructions begin to fade out, bodily energy becomes steady and pure. You're dealing with the quality of the experience. And that is something, you know, we can all, you know, work on. But recognizing that all these wonderful teachings, we have to realize, yeah, that's the template, but this is the cloth I'm living with. It doesn't actually do that very well. You know, I like the idea of the loom, looks beautiful, and the Buddha could do all kinds of things, but I've got, my kit isn't that good. Well, okay, we'll just, you know, do what you can with the body, you know, do what you can with the citta, pure citta, if that's the main thing, purity of heart, and things will come together, but perhaps things aren't ready yet, it's not ripe yet. And so having that sense of maintaining that sense of trust and relationship and not seeking results, but just seeking to bring forth and steady, bright energy, aspiration into daily life, into our living bodies, into our living hearts. It won't do you any harm, that you know. And so the whole section of teachings is really concerned with that. And then you get another section which is worded rather differently. Suddenly the whole language changes into contemplating an association with changeability. Before it wasn't contemplating, it was training. And you're contemplating. It's like stepping back and how is this? Contemplating in line with dispassion. Contemplating in line with what stops, ceasing, bringing things to an end that are no longer needed. Dispelling fantasy. You know, not carrying extra weight you don't need. Cessation. Contemplating in line with relinquishment. So pretty much flowing along in the lines of that sequence that we listened to in the Buddha's presentation on these enlightenment factors. This is giving you the microcosmic application. How do you cultivate withdrawal? What is that about? What's its support? What's its basis? What's its fruition? It's this simple recognition, changeability, feelings, sensations, forms, energies, breathing in, breathing out. There's nothing solid there at all. Nothing can be solid. Nothing is supposed to be solid. Yeah. The very mind that's trying to cultivate that is also not solid, changeable. Because of that, there's a recognition of here, pushing and holding on will not work. Getting impatient and trying to make it steady is not going to work. And cultivates a lightness, dispassion. Let it be how it is, and yet with a careful attention. And that quality of dispassion and seclusion that atmosphere has a tangible effect. Suddenly the pressures release and the obsessiveness releases and the desperation and the aiming and the can't get there and wow, I've got a great one today, I really had a good meditation. All that ceases. Because the most important thing is that sense of purity of heart and dispassion. It's stable. It's easeful. It's not varnishing anything. It's not striking up the brass band because you've got three mindful inhalations. Nor is it going into a whole kind of sorrowful opera just because you've got a few moments of ill will or craving popping up. It's just, okay, let it pass. A little dispassion. And that alleviation of intensity as you breathe it, as you feel it in your breathing, transfers that heart quality into this reflexive, unconscious, or aspects of our nature which seem to be beyond our reach. We get reactive, we get gut reactions, we get stuck. And our efforts to release it don't work, but dispassion does. It penetrates where the controlling person can't go. It penetrates where our trying to change ourselves and make ourselves better, that's a good idea if it doesn't go that deep. You get into core reactions and attitudes that are so ingrained, you think you can never get past this. Okay, dispassion. 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 It begins to ease, soften. And at a certain point, compulsions arise. You can see them more clearly as momentary energies that dissolve. Oh, I didn't, it's beyond the I am. That's why the Buddha sees this, teaches this. This is going past where I can do this. So along with the ending of some of these compulsive reflexes, the whole sense of identity as being the vehicle that we ride begins to change. We become more open, more humble, more surrendering into this process. However long it takes. So getting in impatient isn't going to work. That's not going to be helpful. Cessation of certain attitudes of becoming. Cessation of certain senses of progress and decline of time. Cessation of fixed views about myself. Cessation of, all that. And this also has its results. The citta deepens and is released from this identification experience. When it's released from this, it's like the compression and the patterning and shaping of the citta. Its behaviors begin to also soften and, we suddenly experience our hearts and minds in a new light. They're actually wider, more free than we ever thought. They're more nameless than we ever imagined. They're more undefinable. And that feels very secure. because we're not proving anything or getting anywhere. Relinquishment. Yeah, you can see as this step-by-step process, you're taking it, always starting and returning again to those fundamental steps we can make. I can cultivate relational sensitivity to some degree, and I can develop that. I can develop mindfulness to some degree, and I can keep working on that. That enables me to get some sense of perspective upon my moods and attitudes. I can get some sense of non-reaction to them, withdrawal from them, and I can keep working on that. And the recommendation is, fine, keep doing that. Keep doing that. That's the course. That's the way. And don't ever move away from that. The highs, the lows, yeah, the positions, the non-positions, you know, feeling you're nobody, feeling you're somebody. Don't waver from that sense of dispassion, openness. This too will change. This is the course for the fulfillment of these factors which ripen in equanimity and lead to release. So let's continue in our practice in silence today. We have this wonderful opportunity. You know, we've all agreed upon and supported, and everybody should be congratulated for their support of this. Recognize, obviously, it's uncomfortable at times, it gets tedious at times, we get tired at times, we get irritated by this and that, but we keep going. And that's beautiful. That's the everyday beauty and the purity of this practice. So let's make a full opportunity of it.